Welcome to the Nerds Podcast number 790. This episode is brought to you by Loot Crate, a how often subscription box service, Kyle?
I believe it's every 12 years.
No.
No? It's not decacentennial?
It's a time capsule?
It's not decacentennial.
I was really proud to pull that out of nowhere.
Well, for once, I just
else is in
like
your ass?
Share real information with you, Chris. It's
Matt
monthly.
Myra.
It's monthly.
It's monthly. Matt Myra's right. It's not
God,
every 12.
Kyle. God, if there's one person you know how to get the right dates for the things for promotions
every
on, Matt Myra.
Every 4 weeks, every 30 days, it's monthly.
Well, is it the kind of thing where they throw great pop culture stuff randomly curated into a box so
well,
that you can get things
based
on themes?
Well, at least you got that part right, Kyle.
Well, I mean, I know a great product when I see one.
You have until the 19th each month at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive that month's crate. And then when the cutoff happens, it's over. These are unique, one-of-a-kind items. You will form a community in the world of other loot craters when you'll notice, like, I got that t-shirt too, or that keychain, or whatever it is. But it's really great stuff. It's less than $20 a month, but you're going to get at least a $40 plus value. Yeah, of course it's a bargain. And it's you forget that you've subscribed. It just runs in the background of
it's
your life.
It's almost like I have a cool best friend who knows all the pop culture stuff I like and sends it to
and
me.
And you're
once
that
a
friend,
month.
Or a loved one, or a friend, sends it to you.
Nah, I wouldn't go that far.
Go to lootcrate.com/nerdist and enter the code Nerdist to save 10% on any new subscription. If you live in Canada, Australia, the UK, whatever, it's fine. They'll get it to you. This is a very good experience. It's not just getting stuff every month. There's real stories behind it and a real community behind it.
I call them Loot Crate, but they're actually called Loot Crate. Subscribe to Loot Crate today.
Boy, yeah. You're really fucking Matt Myra-ing it up over here.
Praise from the king!
Oh, I don't know if I'd like me either.
LootCrate.com/Nerdist. Enter the promo code Nerdist. Thanks to Loot Crate for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. What's on the community corkboard?
All sorts of fun stuff. You want to go first?
Yeah. Jacqueline Novak, who is a hilarious comedian and all-around cool person,
agreed,
has a new book called How to Weep in Public, Feeble Offerings on Depression from One Who Knows. It's out now, and she's really funny. She's been on You Made It Weird talking about her depression, and she really does make it funny and interesting and informative. So definitely check it out.
Excellent. What else?
I am running a show on Nerd Melt on March 11th at 9 p.m. called Retro Rad, and it's me and Caitlin Durante, and we are going through old, it's basically obscure media on Reddit, but as a show. Where we're showing just crazy clips from old TV shows, and then we do a Win Ben Stein's Money contest where we have the audience and our guests and everybody else compete against me in a trivia contest.
And the trivia contest is actually just about jokes from
Win Ben Stein's Money. It's a lot of Jimmy Kimmel work. Stay away from
that. It's very, so very niche, but I
it's
enjoy
almost
it.
Like it's in the theater in the back of a comic book store.
Matt, do you have a community corkboard item?
I do indeed, Christopher.
What is it, Matthew?
On Saturday, March 12th, 2016. At South by Southwest.
In Austin, Texas?
Yes, at 7 p.m. to 9 p.m., the Jonah Carey podcast.
Hey, that's on the Nerdist Sports.
Yes, that is absolutely right. We'll be there. I will be there with Jonah, co-hosting some sports garbage talk.
Phoebe's Matt Myra?
Phoebe's Matt Myra will be there. Come out. It's at...
I like James Bonding's Matt Myra.
I prefer the Frasier one.
It's
I
at like Drinks Lounge, everybody. Drinks Lounge in Austin, Texas. That's 2001 East Cesar Chavez Street. Come see us 7 p.m. March 12th, the Jonah Carey podcast. There's gonna be beer. There's gonna be me. There's gonna be Jonah Carey. There's gonna be
that's
fun.
About it.
Just fun.
You squeeze a lot of juice out of that.
And then you can also listen to the podcast on the Nerdist Network every
right.
Friday.
I'm gonna be doing a beta. Is that everything? I don't want to cut you off.
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Good.
You have a good time. Check out.
Yeah, I'll see you down there because we're doing the live at midnight show the Friday, which is Friday the 11th. At 9 p.m., we seem to be doing... we're at Parrish is the name of the venue.
We seem to be doing
I couldn't remember the name of the... And I looked it up real fast.
It appears we're doing an event.
If calendar is correct, now we're going to be doing a live at midnight just for Periscope.
Oh, nice.
So it's not going to air on Comedy Central. We're just going to do it on Periscope.
I'm sad that I can't be there to see that. That would be great.
I'm sad that you can't be there too, but you're moderating a really cool panel.
I am.
So that'll be fun.
Look, they sold out, so you can't come see my panels.
What's your panel that we can't go
to? It's Vice Principals, the new show from Danny McBride.
Oh, nice.
With the Goggins.
It's
supposed to be a hoot. I get to see it this week. They'll send me a link. They're still editing right now, but I'll be prepared to.
Yeah, so with the spillover of people who didn't get into that, come to see at midnight. I I think there's going to be some fantastic comedians there that are relevant to your At Midnight interests, and we're doing it all on Periscope. And then also March 15th, that's a Tuesday, different than we normally do, beta test at Meltdown, 9 p.m.
Tuesday beta test.
Go to nerdmeltla.com.
Why are we doing it Tuesday?
Because the Monday night show, I didn't want to boot. I think maybe Andy Kindler's doing a show on that Monday.
You wouldn't hear the end of it.
Didn't want to boot him off. Even though I could have. I would never do that.
Hear me out.
So we're doing...
line down, sitcom style, down the stage. You both do your shows simultaneously.
He was so funny at the Improv last week. Oh, I did your show at the Improv with Kindler and Dana Gould and Laura Keitlinger. And Kindler, and they were all amazing. And Louis dropped in. Andy is so fucking funny. He kills me.
But putting a line down the middle for separate comedy shows, you just essentially described what happens at Just for Laughs in Toronto when Todd Glass and Andy Kindler do a show together at the comedy bar. It's the best.
This episode also brought to you by Stamps.com. Stamps.com. Why go to the post office? Don't do it. Just print it out from your home.
Mm.
Right? You don't want to get kicked in the neck by postage meter rates.
Ooh.
Ink is expensive at home, but it ain't as expensive as stamps, bitches.
You will never pay full price.
New slogan.
You will never pay full price again for postage. Use your own computer, print it all out, and then you just hand it to your mail carrier, drop it in the mailbox. It's that easy. Over 500,000 small businesses are already using Stamps.com. Sign up for Stamps.com. Use a promo code Nerdist. You get a 4-week trial, $110 bonus offer, including postage and digital scale.
And that free scale, yeah.
So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com before you do anything else.
You can use that scale for postage, for cocaine, for
click at the microphone
salmon.
At the top of the homepage.
You want to know what?
Don't mail the cocaine,
salmon.
Though.
Don't mail it.
Click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Nerdist. People might think it's anthrax.
Smoke some salmon. I mean, both are illegal.
Smoke
one's
some salmon high on cocaine.
Click on the microphone at the top of the page and type in Nerdist at stamps.com. Enter the promo code Nerdist. Very, very excited about this podcast. This is Michael Showalter and Sally Field.
What?
Yes, I know. The movie is called Hello, My Name is Doris, which is a movie that Showalter co-wrote and directed. And Sally Field is the star, and she plays Doris. The movie is delightful and heartbreaking and wonderful and funny, and there's a lot of great Kumails in it. There's a lot of great people in it that you recognize. That is in theaters March 11th in LA and New York. Wide release March 18th. Go support good film.
Do it.
My name is Doris. Sally Field, amazing in the film, wonderful on this podcast. And so here we go, the Nerdist Podcast number 790 with Sally Field and Michael Showalter.
Wait, one more thing to add about that Jonah Carey podcast. I just read, no badge required. And it's free.
Or jacket.
And there's free beer. So just go to that.
So Phil Collins lovers will appreciate
it. No, I don't have a badge or a jacket. I'm having a great day.
All right, good.
Su Studio.
You just made it in.
Oh, thank God.
throw me the whip. I throw you the idol. Katie, roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Why are you hungry?
No, I'm fine.
Did we feed you pretzels?
We did.
Thank you, Kyle.
No problem.
I'm not feeding Sam.
That is the kind of professional organization that I didn't realize we
could have
the capacity
we could have done.
He went over to At Midnight and stole them from Craft Services.
Did you steal them from At Midnight?
I sure did.
Ah, oh, thank you.
And when I realized that he was going over there, I was like, "Well, Lynn, get me some fruit and some other stuff."
Oh yeah, yeah. Craft Services.
But you were gone before.
It's a shoot day, so.
Oh. Do you want me to send Kyle on a fruit run? What do you want? A pear, an apple, an orange?
Oh, I'm a big fan of watermelon, cantaloupe.
Good God, people.
Any sort of a citrus. I've been on kind of a grapefruit
thing, and
kick
you can go to
lately.
Lunch. My goodness, we're asking these
well,
people.
Well, I'm hoping
to
they
feed
have
you.
A really good food spread at our
I've
next,
known Showalter for next. Probably 20 years, so it doesn't mind. I don't mind.
Everybody does that. All of these people, hordes of people coming up to him. Like, I've known him since I can't. It's like, okay.
Chris and I were at MTV when MTV was
there
MTV.
You go.
In the 1900s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right.
Really? All the way back then?
All the way back in the 1900s when kids had to watch TV when it aired. Now it doesn't, matter.
And when Full House was just
when
Full House
was in its initial run.
First run, Full House.
We just met the Tanner family. Yeah. Yeah, we were here 3 years ago at MTV. I would never expect you to remember this, but of course I remember it.
Oh, dear.
Flying back from Memphis in 2013, and you were sitting across the aisle. You were coming back from Memphis.
I was in Memphis?
You were in Memphis, and this might trigger...
Was I drunk?
I don't know. You slapped the stewardess and said, where's my ham? I don't know what that meant.
Yeah, it was a secret code we had between each other.
Maybe you'll remember this. When we landed at LAX, the airport was shut down because someone had run a truck into one of the parking structures.
Oh, yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Well, what the hell was I doing? In Memphis, I was promoting. I was in the midst of promoting, I think.
I think that's great. Not that many people go to Memphis to promote anything. So
I think I must have been diverted from someplace else. I don't know.
That's the more likely
scenario. I don't know what I was doing.
Could have been visiting Graceland.
Or the Civil Rights Museum.
Yeah. Wait a minute. I was
there with you.
Yes, I was. That's exactly.
What were you doing?
We were getting the promotion for Lincoln, I believe it was.
It was a speech somewhere.
Oh, yeah, but give a speech. I had to give a speech somewhere.
Well, I'm glad. I hope it went better than when we landed. When we landed,
I know you remember that.
You couldn't get out.
It was
of the
crazy,
airport.
And you and I went some circuitous route, wasn't
yes.
it? And
yes.
we said, "Let's take this route."
But wait,
it was you and I.
Out?
We were going down the tunnels.
Actually
yes,
hung out?
We were.
We were going down the tunnels together, saying, "Don't you think we could get out this way?"
Yes, that's
been.
Amazing that
There's
you remember
whole
that.
Movie we could
it
made
was
out
a whole
that.
Yeah, and it was.
We went down the tunnels, and everybody else was just huddled and taking the no for an answer. And I said, "Let's not take no for an answer."
I think we should actually see if we can get all the surveillance footage and just cut that together as a movie.
I think that was a movie.
Okay,
because
good.
It was called Escaping the Airport.
Escaping Airport. Can I put that on my IMDb page?
Absolutely.
That'd be really great.
Because then didn't you ultimately walk out of the airport? I had to walk out of the airport altogether onto Sepulveda Boulevard.
Yes.
And get a cab.
Yeah.
And then the cab was right said away. He was going to charge me too much, and I demanded he let me out.
So you remember everything.
I had a hissy fit. I demanded he let me out immediately.
He was giving you what's known now as surge pricing.
He was. He saw that there was a problem and everybody was trying to get a cab and I got it at the hotel there. And he was going to charge me like $150 to drive into Brentwood. I mean, it was crazy. I wasn't even
Do you think he identified you as Oscar
No,
Winnie Salas,
he just thought I was a hot one, you know, like not hot like woohoo. I mean, like ready to shell out whatever needed to be shelled out.
Maybe he thought both. Yeah, we got stuck in the airport for a while until they opened up and flooded, and we had no idea.
Airports
I walked
are usually
out.
Where I do take no for an answer.
I didn't take no
time.
For an answer.
That's
I
the one time.
I did not do it.
So how did you guys come together? How did you get involved with this?
Well, we sent her the script. And begged her to do it, and not thinking that she would. And then
I said yes.
Nice enough to meet me for a
So you guys didn't know
coffee.
Each other before?
No.
You just cold kinda...
Message in a bottle. Message in a bottle. Like, what do I have to lose? What do I have to lose? Why not? Worst thing that can happen is she says no.
Yeah.
And we met for coffee out here, and we hit it off.
Yep, we did.
And then... a couple days later, her agent and manager – I don't think you know this.
No, I don't
telling
think
telling you
I
little
do.
Things you don't know.
I didn't know they
and
did
they
that.
Called me and I was like,
they
Hello?
Said I was thinking about it?
No, they go, Sally Field's going to do your movie.
They did say that?
Yes.
Well, because I'd already told them.
Well, they waited a couple days to tell me.
Well, that's – I told them
and they were both – anytime you get the agent and the manager together on the phone –
You know something's going
it's
down.
Almost always good news. They never want to be together when it's bad news.
No one wants to deliver bad news.
So anytime you get like the whole group on a phone call, you know it's good news. And so it was like, I have these two people for you. I don't know why I'm saying I won't say their name, but I'm not going to say their name because who knows?
Who knows?
Anyway, I have these two people for you. And I'm going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. So let me tell you something. She's going to do your movie. But it was like kind of threatening.
But
like
we're
that.
Dropping you.
No, it was threatening. Like it was like, hey, Pipsqueak. Hey,
oh,
Pipsqueak.
No, they weren't disrespectful.
Not disrespectful, but it was like, hey, Pipsqueak. This, you know, iconic person is going to work with you.
That's his reading of it. They're
incredibly
generous.
Is we're going to work with you. Don't
nice.
Don't F it.
I
up.
Said immediately, I want to do this. I want to do this. I want to do this. So that there wasn't any, you know.
How do you pick things? Like, what kind of feeling? What are you looking for when you? Is it reading the script, or is it meeting with someone, or how do you? What is your gut? How do you find that?
This is so unique and such a wonderful character and such a unique story. Of course, I immediately said to Showalter, I said, "Can we pull this off? Is this doable?" Because the comedy is so high. It's such romp, screwball comedy, physical, real clown comedy. And then it's, you haven't gotten that far, so I don't want to spoil it for you, but it gets Greek. I mean, it goes it goes sad.
It gets very sad.
And it has to be woven together really carefully because they're butting up against each other. And I constantly was saying to Michael, "Are we doing this? Is this happening? Is this a blending? Is this good?" And that was exactly there. There's this face. He would just do that slow kind of nod. Yep. We're doing it. It's happening. You just keep going. After every take, I would go, "That was it."
Yeah.
You'd go, "Yeah, that was it."
Because he sucks you in. You're like, we're being sucked in now. The audience is being sucked in. Oh, this is delightful, and this is quirky, and it seems like this guy, there's something, I don't know, well, maybe, I mean, and then you start seeing in the background a little bit, and you're talking with the therapist, and there seems to be stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she's coming out of her shell, the character is, I was reading something about it, and it's like, you know, her smile, she can barely even smile in the beginning of the movie, it's like, almost looks like it hurts her to like, you know, and, but this character that Sally plays lived her whole life kind of like under the thumb of her mom and is sort of like goes to work and punches in and punches out and goes home. And that's what she does every day. And she's really, really quiet and sort of not used to interacting with people when the movie starts. And then she meets this John guy, Max Greenfield, and she slowly comes out of her shell, and it's a very slow burn of watching that happen to see this person like kind of slowly like getting back and sort of rejoining the world a little bit.
How do you see her?
I think she's a borderline personality. I've sort of investigated that she's on the spectrum of will she be okay or will she not be okay, you know. Psychologically, she's a bit of a hoarder, but I always thought, and Michael and I talked about this a lot, that it was the mother that was was really an in-house hoarder, you know, locked inside and kept Doris there with her. So I think that letting the hoarding part go, she might have been able to do perhaps more easily than her mother ever could have. Not that I'm letting you know that she really did let it go, but so she lives in her own fantasy world. She creates this world for herself, and her whole look are all these clothes that she finds in the Goodwill, or she finds on the street, or she finds in the thrift shops, and she just paints pictures with herself on herself every day, but she never sees herself. She isn't connected to the outside world enough to see herself from the outside in, and in her mind she's what she always was. She's, you know, 19, 20, something like that, maybe not even. Because I see this story as a coming of age of a woman of age. And if she was ever out in the world before, open to possibilities and emotionally available, it wasn't really fully.
Sure.
I don't think even then, because her mother was alive, and probably she had one foot in the door of being out in the world and one foot still stuck in that childhood place that was calling her back. And then when she went back, she stayed in that shut-off environment until she's in her late 60s.
Yeah, she was developmentally stunted for a long time.
Definitely, yeah.
But now she kind of gets to live out teenage fantasies.
She becomes 14.
Don't you feel like you always think of yourself in your head that way, though?
Yes, that's what, you know, we talked about that a lot. I see myself still as that and go, wait a minute. I'm older than that. How old am I? And I'm kind of shocked sometimes going, oh, okay, that's what I am. But inside, you're the same. You're still the same. You're the same person you always were. You might have more experience, or you might have more, you know, wisdom of how you want to be or who you are, but you're still the same person.
And you started off in television very young.
Mm-hmm.
Was that – what was being in TV like when you started? I mean, obviously, the media, everything was – entertainment was so much different.
So much different.
And so what did it – because I know you grew up in Southern California. Mm-hmm. So what – was it just, well, I'm here and there's a television industry here, so this seems like a thing I want to do. And what did it mean to be on TV at that time?
Well, I think it was huge, but I had a little Doris in me, and that I kept my perspective so tiny, probably to save myself. I had been acting in junior high and high school when they were drama departments. I went to Birmingham High School in the San Fernando Valley. And in junior high, in the seventh grade, it was called junior high, they had a theater arts department, and that's when I found the theater. But I grew up in a working class show business family. They were working class. My stepfather was a stuntman, and my mother was an actress, but it was working class, so it was really a tough life. They'd, you know, she'd get a gig, she'd be on Bonanza one week, and then, you know, you wouldn't work for months and months at a time, and you didn't know where the next one was coming.
And that didn't scare you?
Oh, it scared everybody. You know, it's a very fragile existence. We all know that here. It's a very difficult existence to have any sort of security. I didn't expect anything different, and I wasn't even looking for it. I hardly knew where I was going or what I was doing, but I happened to, my stepfather found me a place. I didn't even know New York existed. I'd never been out of the state. I'd never been on an airplane. I was hugely unsophisticated. My stepfather found me a workshop when I graduated from high school, because I thought, well, okay, I didn't take the SATs. Was I going to college? No one even asked me if I was going to college. No one at school said, hey, Miss Sally, what are you going to do with yourself? I was just sort of literally falling in the cracks, was one of those people. And the workshop was located at Old Columbia. I was just saying, this is like I was having deja vu. I was located at the Old Columbia Studios on Sunset and Gower. And the workshop was located on one of the sound stages. And when I did an audition to get into the workshop, I didn't know that the panel to get into the workshop were all casting people from television. And so the next day, I got into the workshop, but I also... there started to be some interest, like, do I have an agent? Was I? Blah, blah, blah. And when I went to my first workshop, which was the following, you know, week, a casting man came out. It was at night. And I was standing on the street corner waiting for my brother to pick me up because I wasn't allowed to drive at night. I was 17. And some man walked up and said, did I want to come on an interview the next day? He was Eddie Voy III, the casting director for Screen Gems, which was the television division of Columbia Pictures. And I went, sure. I didn't have an agent. I was just out of high school. I didn't know nothing. And my stepfather, my stuntman stepfather, took me to the meeting. And I spent that summer of 1964 testing, just reading things and testing. It was just like, you know, a whole new world, folks. And by the end of the summer, by like September, I think it was, I got the part. So,
of Gidget.
Of Gidget. And that was like, welcome to showbiz field.
and also, what an interesting time for television and pop culture, because I think, when I think about it, I didn't think of this at the time. I mean, I watched the reruns of the show, but I didn't think about it at the time. A show with kids running around in bikinis and bathing mm-hmm. suits was probably kind of a culture shock to where America had come out of before. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people are like, it's the downfall of society. These kids have no clothes on.
Well, they were incredibly strict with us. We weren't allowed to have our belly buttons show with these ridiculous two-piece bathing suits that had literally a fourth of an inch of skin showing on your midriff. You know, yeah. It was ridiculous. Not that I, you know, was looking to show more than that. You know, we were right out of the 50s. You know, we were.
Is that not what actual bathing suits looked like? That's, I'm serious.
At the time.
I'm being serious.
They did, but not ones that I would be caught dead in. But
I'm saying like that. Like
they were.
If you went to the store and bought a bathing suit, did it show belly button?
They were a little bit more revealing that,
but not much.
Yeah. Not much.
Yeah.
So, but it was a very different time in television, in the entertainment industry altogether, in every way.
Did that show come back after the show got canceled but then came back because
Well,
of
no, syndication? They put me in another series after that, which was The Flying Nun.
Flying Nun, yeah.
Yeah.
Which you didn't like.
No.
That was not fun.
No.
What? They were just dicks?
Yeah. No.
I mean, that's...
You know, there's a lot of reasons. And it's like, how much time do we have for me to go? We could spend days talking about the reasons why it was
I
torture.
I would listen.
I was going to be in an angst situation no matter what, because I was 19, 20, 21, and heading into 20. I mean, those are the years when you like going, who am I? Why am I? And I was dressed as a nun. And mind you, it's the 60s. Everybody is dropping acid and eating granola and running around naked.
Granola?
Well, you know, it was like, you know, hippies.
Did they ever explain why she could fly?
You know what?
Was it the hat?
I think it was the habit.
It was the hat. They said it was the hat, yeah. You know. But believe me, and then she was so little, and I am little, but she was so little and the hat was so big that when the winds came up, it just lifted her up. But I was so depressed that I weighed 800 pounds by day 4 of shooting. So the fact, you know, how they could get this, you know,
that
woman off
the
ground.
The wind.
Yeah, the wind. Yeah.
It's pretty windy up
there.
There
you have it. One of the reasons I was so depressed is because it's written all over his face right there. It's hysterical. Look at his face. It was hard to be that for 3 years and be forming who you are in your head. This is who I am. And also realizing what I really wanted to be was an actor, and this weren't it.
And it was also media was much more segmented at that time. If you were a TV person, you were a TV person,
yes.
Not a film
and there
person.
You will die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you started working with Strasberg.
Yes.
And that kind of helped break you out of the TV.
Well, no, I had to break out just by sheer, I'm going to do this or I'm going to die. And literally, I'm going to slice my wrists and rub it all over your doorway. You know, I had to want it more than I wanted to
The wind
to,
will carry you there.
Live. Yeah, really. It's those moments. I really think that those moments, those times in your life when you feel you're in a deep ditch and you're never going to get out, and you're just it's what you do during those really down times that really inform who you're going to be the rest of your life, and always do. They always are the times you get, you know, creative. And so I just kept going, studying, and quit doing television. I stopped doing television. I tell them I'm not doing any more television, folks. And I think I didn't work for, I had two little kids by then. I didn't work for like 3 years.
But you still, were you completely freaked out?
Oh, yeah. I'm selling it. I mean, I was then reliving what my family had gone through all of their lives, where we were constantly repossessed. You know, we were like, woohoo, we're movie stars. Look at this. We've got 4 jobs in a row. Let's spend it all. And then they would come and get the house and the car, and we'd have to move. So you kind of went, oh. I was always afraid that that was going to happen to me. But
how did you, like, Showalter... Because Showalter's background is, you know, comedy, sketch comedy.
I know.
It was one of the smartest sketch groups ever, the State.
Know.
How did you guys, at the time, did you ever feel like, oh, I don't know if this is going to work? Or
oh, my God. I mean, yeah. The State?
Yeah. I mean, just, but that, because that was such an amazing time for comedy in 92, because the 80s comedy boom was over and this kind of alternative comedy movement happened, and the State was really surfing that.
Mm-hmm.
But there were not as many opportunities for traditional comedy on television at that point because they had been exhausted by the
80s. Completely, yeah. No, I mean, there was also no internet to make videos for. There was no – it was old school, you know, put on a show and hope to get discovered still. MTV was an interesting place to be, as you know. But we were like a band. I think that like our trajectory as a comedy group was much the way you see a band work, which was like constantly infighting, a lot of good ideas.
Well, there were like 11 of you.
There were 11 of us, all big personalities, all really ambitious. None of us ever set out to be in a sketch comedy troupe. It wasn't like what I want to do in my career is go meet a bunch of people and like be in a sketch troupe and then get good at a TV show. It was like I want to go to college and I wanted to be like a cinema studies guy. Like I thought I wanted to be in academics because that's what my family background is. And And then I fell in love with comedy as a kid, but then yeah, like we were like a fast burning candle is how I like to think of the state. We were really fast burning.
But everyone in the state went on to do amazing things. Yes, like yes. Every single person
yeah,
from that.
And we pushed each other. We still, I think a lot of us owe our still having careers to just how much kind of like family brothers, you know, a bunch of brothers competing, like pushing each other to stay in the game and to do good work and all that stuff. And so, you know, we're still all in many different forms still working together. But I mean, I met Michael Black and Joe Lotruglio like the first week I was a freshman in college in 1988.
Wow. By the time this podcast is over, Tom Lennon will have written 3 more scripts. I got to wait. I got to get this done. Come on, man. I got to pitch this shit.
And Ben will have checked no emails.
Your relationship to comedy was always – it seemed like it was always important. But it also seemed like it was important for you to having to start branching off to not get typecast as just a comedy person.
I don't think I ever fought against typecasting. I just fought to be able to do projects that were worth being a part of. So the typecasting wasn't part of it. But certainly it went hand in hand, because when I was trying to get away from projects that were rotten into projects that were good, you know, it led me out of just being the cute little situation comedy girl. And as I was transitioning into an older person, older and older. But I love comedy. And comedies, you know, I love comedy. I would, if I had a druther, it would be to do what, you know, Michael created, in that it's everything. You know, it is both really comedic and clown-like, and then really dramatic.
I think Soap Dish is one of the best comedies in the history of comedy.
Oh God, thank you.
That movie, I saw it not that long ago, and it, aside from like Robert Downey Jr.'s shoulder pads, the movie completely holds up. The comedy in the movie completely holds up.
Yeah. Oh, that was you know, and great fun, and just inspired lunacy, complete and inspired lunacy.
I don't know if they make. Are there just like weird ensemble madcap movies anymore? I feel like it's not. Everything's so kind of linear now, yeah. And gritty, and you know. But that, where you just had an ensemble cast of all amazing performers, yeah. And you'd throw them together with a good, you know, with just like a good solid joke base.
Yeah, joke. It was just, you know, one joke after the other, and it's everybody is shot into space. You know, we're all on some sort of weird drug because woo! You know, the energy level is way up from the get-go. It was exhausting, actually.
I mean, when you're doing something like that, or you just have to trust the director. Like, okay, I guess this is all gonna. I mean, do you ever act outside your comfort zone because you feel like, well, this is what they want, or is there a push and pull? Like, I think I should do it this way.
It's really hard for me to go and commit to something that, in my core, doesn't feel. That I can't find the land that it lives in. I find that very difficult. I've really then become so difficult to work with.
well, what about when you were doing Nun?
Well, yeah, that was.
What was that like?
It was hell, but it wasn't hell because they were asking me to do things that were, you know, in a land that I couldn't arrive. Like asking me to do emotional things. It was the nonsense. It was spouting. Utter and total nonsense all day long, every day, from before the sun went up till after the sun went down, in a nun's habit. So, you know, there wasn't ever about anything human.
Yeah.
It was, you know, some robbers had come to the island, yeah. And, you know, yeah. We're going to take the thing, and then Carlos was going to, yeah. So what?
Carlos?
Yeah, never mind. You had to have been there.
Because I definitely feel like I, you know, whether in almost any kind of thing, to do something that's not, that I don't believe in on some level is painful. Mm-hmm. It's excruciatingly mm-hmm. painful.
Yeah. But that's why.
Whether as a writer, in the limited experiences I've had as an actor, to try to do work that you don't believe in it, even it doesn't have to mean that it's, you know, shedding light on the human experience, but just that you believe in it.
Yeah.
You don't do that. I literally, I'd rather do something else. For me, if it's going to be this, I would actually rather go do something else entirely,
or not do anything.
I would go do like try to go you know, be a cop or something.
Oh,
like that.
You mean
like,
a whole other occupation?
A whole other occupation,
not like, another it's not project. Worth, it's a not whole worth other it.
So you're playing a cop? No, I'm a cop.
In my mind, I'm saying that pain of
too.
I have an idealistic thing of like, you know, that I'm going to do something good. And so, and if it's not that, then I'll go do something else that could be good.
You'll
like
make a living some other way.
Yes.
You just need to be happy. You just need to be happy. You need to be able to look yourself in the mirror every day and go, I'm okay with what I'm
well,
doing.
Well, and then on some level, what I'm doing has some value.
Sure.
Yeah.
But from what perspective, like what value?
To some internal part of me that thinks it has value.
Can you see Showalter being a police officer?
I could be a detective.
You could just be a detective.
I could be a detective.
Can I be a detective? I was in this really great sketch group. Sure.
I want to wear a trench coat. A
lot of unsolved murders.
I want to wear a trench coat and the hat and the notebook.
I can see you being one of those police officers, those cops that direct the traffic. That
Sally.
But no, she's saying you're a good director.
It would be great.
No.
Let's try to.
She's taking a pot shot at
me. No, I can't see you coming in with a gun and saying, everybody goes to the
I said I'm a detective.
Okay. Well, even then.
I'm an investigator.
Even then, you have to. Investigator.
I'm an investigator.
All right. At a desk and a thing.
No, I'm.
No, you're in the field.
I'm. What's his face from Law and Order? The
Lenny,
the tall. What's his name?
Chris Noth.
Jerry Orbach. Jerry Orbach.
All right.
Okay.
I want to be Jerry Orbach.
So you're the gumshoe with the loose tie and the snarky comments.
All right. All right.
You're packing heat.
All right.
You
could do that. You're packing heat though, really, because sometimes
I am packing heat. I am packing heat.
It does come to that every now and then, and you're ready for it.
I am packing heat.
Someone's gonna run.
And I will unpack my.
So you would be the guy that would come in with the loose tie. You'd find a dead body in the meatpacking district.
No, he doesn't find it. He gets called in.
He gets called in. Yeah, exactly. He goes
and
in
you
and
kind
then
of
he,
mosey yeah. in, going,
yes,
"All right,
yes,
what's up
yes,
now?
Yeah, get out of my way."
You see all the meat hanging in the dead body. And you're like, "Who wants cheeseburgers?" Like you do that kind of stuff.
Yes, exactly. Like I've seen it all.
Yeah,
you're saying I make a joke because I've seen it all.
You don't blink.
Nothing phases me.
Nothing phases you. Yeah, but surely you must have. I mean.
Yes, I have, but please don't call me Shirley.
Oh, come on.
Then I would.
Why would you? That's an old.
I know. Classic.
Showalter. You get back to your desk and start solving those murders. Huh? These murders aren't going to solve themselves. You're
and
in
take
here.
Take that gun out.
Making
of your
airplane
pocket,
jokes.
Big boy.
But you must have. I'm sure you must have been on stuff when everyone's intentions were good coming in. Everyone had the best intentions. The script was great. Halfway through, you realize, this isn't really what I thought it was going to be.
No.
Never? That's never happened?
No, I've been on things that you knew going in, you're going to hate yourself every inch of the way, but you need to make a living. So find a way to get through it, and it's just hell.
Did anyone ever surprise you when you went, you know, that actually wasn't as bad as I thought it was going to be? Okay.
No.
Not a one person.
Not even one teeny?
No.
Okay. All right. Maybe just a sang. Well, what happened in between Nun and having kids and then Sybil? Like what broke that?
I worked my way into because I wasn't even no one had let me on a list. I couldn't get on a list to get in the door, much less get to the reading or get through the first meeting with the casting person. I couldn't get on a list. They didn't want me in the door. But a casting woman who knew an actress that I had worked with, and also I was working at the Actors Studio all the time, and I was doing really kind of outrageous. You know, I was doing the respectful prostitute at night, and I was doing the flying nun in the day. But, you know, there were some years that went by here, but I was still working at the Actors Studio a lot. And I think at that time, the Actors Studio was really an interesting place here. There was so much, so many actors were coming out of it and who were real, really good actors who were working in film at the time. And this was in the 70s. Now we're already into like 75 and 76 and those years. And what film was at that time was changing, and Easy Rider was coming in and Five Easy Pieces and all of that sort of they were pushing the envelope of what American film was, taking it out of that real glossy look of the early 60s and the late 50s and into a grittier look of, you know, Alice doesn't live here anymore and all of these things that were coming out. And Bob Rafelson had a movie, and the casting director had knew an actress that I had worked with, and the actress had said to the casting director that they should let me in, that no one really knew what I was. But I went into the meeting and could hear Bob Rafelson yelling at the casting director from the other room that how dare she waste his time with me.
So how do you push through that?
You get really frigging angry. and by then I had learned how to what the art of an audition was, even though I had never been on an audition. I'd never been allowed. Only audition I'd ever been on was Gidget. After that, I was never allowed. And but I had trained then. I'd been working, and I knew what the audition was, and I knew how to harness that. I knew how to use that. I knew what to do. I knew that they were never going to hire me. They had to think they were hiring the character, and they had to think that everything I had done before was just one heck of an acting job, because really I was this little, you know, floozy girl that worked in a gym that, you know, was really just a girl that just couldn't wait to do all the things that the Flying Nun never thought of, you know. Mm-hmm. So I just had to be that character. I had to be that. So it wasn't the audition and you go into a reading and then you take your moment and you read the scene. I had to be that 24 hours a day. And they thought, whoa, wait, this is really? And that's who Gidget the Flying Nun was? That's surprising.
That is mentally exhausting.
And mentally exhausting and infuriating and exhausting. And so I had to do reading after reading, and then finally got to read with Jeff Bridges, who's in it. And, of course, adored him. And, you know, and finally I knew how to do the work. And I just knew I had to be surprisingly better, but surprising in every way. So when I first came into the first meeting that I had, and I was being treated very much with disregard, and you're not cruel, but they just weren't interested, and they'd done a lot of readings that day with a lot of other actors. At the end of the day, like, when do we go? Okay, go ahead, you can do your reading now, you know. I was reading with the writer, who was the most god-awful reader. He didn't care, or he just was really that bad. So I threw my pages on the floor. I didn't throw, just let them drop. And I walked over to him that was sitting in the chair next to me, took his script out of his hand, and he was going, but, and proceeded to straddle him. I stood over him and sat down on him and straddled him and looked him directly in the face, and he's like going, whoa, whoa. And he said, I don't know the pages. I said, well, then fake it.
Oh, man, you took over the room.
I took over the room. And, of course, I'm the shyest human being.
So that's not how your meeting with Showalter went.
It kind of was the same thing.
Okay.
It was in reverse.
But anyway, I got the role slowly but surely.
Wow. And from that, I mean, did you guys expect Smoking the Bandit to be the crazy hit that it was? Or did you think, like, oh, people might enjoy this?
No.
It was like the number two movie of 1977 or something like that.
Yeah. No one did. No.
It's the same year Star Wars came out. It must have been Star Wars and then Smoking the Bandit.
Yeah.
Was it Star Wars that year?
77 was Star Wars.
Really?
Yeah. So what...
Yeah, no, no one knew that. It was just, you know, it was a fluke, and you just kind of, you know, it was a really quick shoot, and I guess in that way, you know, it was surprising, because who knew what it was? But I didn't go into it thinking, oh, God, there was no script. I mean, literally, we improvised our way through the whole thing.
Then Jackie Gleason would just come on and swear a bunch, and...
You know, yeah, I mean, it was kind of just... But what wasn't improvised is Hal Needham's brilliant stunts. I mean, Hal Needham was a great stunt coordinator, and he had been. He was a great stunt man, and then he became the stunt coordinator, and he crafted all of these things, and then he knew where to put the camera and how to make it visible, and also how to protect his stunt people. He started Stunts Unlimited and all of that. And so you just, you know, you had these actors that just improvised in a car, you know, three sets of cars, and one guy's with a dog the whole
time. Jerry Reed.
Jerry Reed. And these just funny stunts that are funny. And, you know, just caught a moment.
It was a weird moment in the 70s when, like, trucking and trucker shows and trucker movies and Convoy and all that. And, like, you know, my grandfather had the CB radio and everyone, like, Smokey and the Bandit kind of broke all that mainstream.
Yeah.
Was your family into that when you were growing up?
Yeah, I had a CB radio, Breaker 19.
Breaker 19.
I think that all came from Smokey.
I think it did.
Sure. It did. There was a, I mean, getting, being a kid and getting that CB radio was, you just reminded me of that, was like, that was like, the, you know, oh God, yeah, totally.
And now we just have these communication devices in our pockets. Yeah. In the old days, and you needed a handle.
Remember this thing? You go by a truck and you go like that.
And you pull your arm down.
And then they would honk their horn for you.
Yep.
You know, and like, you know, and it's like, totally. That was totally a Smokey thing.
Will they still do that?
Yes, I think they must. They'll still do that.
That's still part of the trucker code.
I'll let you know today.
Still part of the trucker code.
For sure.
But what is it that motivates you? What is it that kind of get, you know, like, what is it that you're trying to do with each part? Is it an exploration of yourself, or is it some external thing that you're looking for?
Oh, it's a conversation with myself. It's you know, like Donald Trump, basically. Yeah.
Will you please be president? Because I would love for you to be president right now.
It's a way to communicate with myself, with pieces of myself that I might not have, you know, looking for them in a craft, and how I, you know, talk to parts of myself that I don't communicate with normally, and it, you know, it really is a conversation with an audience, a faceless audience, that, you know, to sound really maudlin, but it is what keeps me from being isolated. When I'm doing that, I feel so connected to a conversation that it's hard to explain, but it, because I guess it is, it's what I do. It's my communication with the planet, with everybody.
Does the entertainment industry get in the, it's such an interesting business, because it attracts artistic types, but then there's this other kind of weird political structure of the entertainment business that gets in the way. And this is also appropriate just coming out of the Oscars. But it's just such a strange – it's two things that are layered on top of one another that seem very strange. So did the politics of the business and all that – any of that stuff and the awards stuff, I mean, is that just kind of like, ugh, I wish I could just scrape that out of the way and just do the work, or do you mind that part?
I try not to look at that part. I think what I do is I compartmentalize. And I think I got very good at doing that, being a little girl raised in the 50s when there were so many things you just weren't allowed to feel. But there are things that are human beings feel. You feel rage and you feel sexuality and you feel all sorts of things that, oh, no, little girls don't do that. So I think you put them in boxes and hide them away in places all around your interior house.
Sure.
And I think I was good at that. So even from the beginning, I put it all in a box and put a bow on it and tucked it away. So I didn't look at, you know, even that there was a finished product of things. Does it had come out? You were forced to, like, have to see and feel what the reaction to things were. But, you know, even as I got older and was deeper into the business, I was able to just keep that's that, and there it is. And when I have to deal with that, I'll step into that and deal with it. But mostly I just wouldn't look at it, wouldn't respond to it, wouldn't feel it.
Does winning an Academy Award feel the way you think it's going to feel, or is there a depression afterwards? Because you're like, well, I don't know. What am I supposed to feel now? Like, or is it elating the whole time? How does it?
It's better than a sharp stick in the eye.
Sure.
it isn't that it's not anything. It's certainly something, and certainly, you know, feels, you know, a great deal of accomplishment, especially for me, because it took me so long to get out of feeling that I was just a joke, but. But honestly, it is all about that moment. You did a project that the work worked enough and caught enough of a wave in that moment of in the industry that it was recognized. It doesn't mean that there weren't a whole lot of other films that could very well have been recognized or other performances, but these were the five, it used to be five and now it's 10 or whatever, that were recognized, and this is the one that won. So it, of course, felt incredibly rewarding at that moment, but it fades quickly because it's always about that moment. And the life is about, and most especially this industry is about, now what?
Mm-hmm.
Then what? Now who are you? But life is about that. You can't hold on to what you were and what that was. That was. And that will inform who you will be. But that is not, that won't be anymore.
I'm curious for Showalter, from a guy who, I mean, I always thought of the state as like, this is sort of a punk comedy movement, like punk rock for comedy. And it's the, it's not mainstream. It's you know, at the time we would say it was for the kids, you know, and I was the kids.
Really?
I was. Okay. I mean, we're the same age, but was in the MTV generation. Okay. I mean, like would have, show was for me.
Yes, yes.
It was not the traditional sketch comedy show. It was, and it was, it was different in that way, and it spoke to me.
By the people for the
people. By the people for the people. Yes, yeah, yes. Exactly. So how do you handle kind of become – like if you become super mainstream, can you handle that? Or do you feel like you always kind of have to be a little rebellious, a little punk, a little – you know, will you be – can you handle mainstream success?
Yeah, I think so.
All right.
It's taken a long time, you know. It's – I've had a very circuitous route to having like a little more work than I'm used to having, and I wouldn't say I've paid my dues, but like, you know, I've like thought about it a lot, you know, and I've trial and error really honed in on like the kind of career that I'm pretty sure I want to have,
mm-hmm.
and there's a version of success in a mainstream world that I could be, that I could participate in, that could work for me.
Sure.
And I think I've figured out a lot for myself just on a personal level, just, you know, dealing with personal life stuff, to where maybe before I couldn't handle it and now maybe I can, just in just the more of the way of, to a lesser degree of what Sally's talking about with winning an Oscar, which is like, if I won an Oscar, I'd like, you know, I can't say on the air what I would want to do.
But, can say anything. It's a podcast. It's
you
the
just
internet.
Use your imagination.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Oh, wow.
It would be like,
that's
just
really
what you would want to do with the Oscar?
No, well, sure. It would be like, I'd want to like, I don't know, I'd want to like, you know, it's something I wouldn't even be doing, but I'd want to like, you know, like Al Pacino and Scarface or something, you know, like a giant mountain of cocaine and,
right.
And like,
oh,
a, you know, and
okay,
like a big,
kind of
and like a, and like a, you know, like a machine gun and just like, you know, like,
I hope someone.
Here you go with that gun thing in your pocket again.
Yes, Jerry Orbach.
He just Showalter just wants to be famous enough so that it's not crazy for him to wave a gun around. that's Showalter. Yeah, I tell you what.
No, and for what it's worth, I couldn't hate guns more for what it's worth. But like you have a little bit of success, and it's like, you know, I think I'm at a place now where like I could take that in stride. I know that it's not that in the grand scheme of things, it is like, okay, so, you know, I still gotta drive home in traffic and deal with my family and my obligations and that. So I feel like I'm a little grounded to where like I'm ready to like not need to be that rebellious punky kid that I was for a really long time.
I mean, for Sally, to have the kind of career that you've had and continue to have and will continue to have, I mean, it really is just amazing thing after amazing thing that you've done. And I just – is that – are you – do you have a really strong sense of who you are, and it's separate, kind of what you were saying, separate from all the film stuff, and you're comfortable with yourself? Do you feel comfortable with yourself?
No.
Really?
Not totally. I think I'm always working on feeling comfortable with myself. Some days, no, I'm always sort of like irritated. I don't know if I'm really comfortable with myself. I don't even like the thought of it, really, because that means you will like be, you know,
Are you saying that's what I said?
No, he
no,
asked.
No, I
me.
Asked.
But are
I
you insinuating
asking.
That that's
no,
what I said?
No, no, no. I don't think you ever were. I would never said you were.
I'm paranoid.
That you said
I take
I was
back what I said. I take back what I said.
It's too late.
That, I take it back.
No, it's too late.
No, we'll erase
words
it.
Words have power.
He can erase it.
You can't erase
it
from Sally Field's brain.
Wait a minute. That I think that you said that you were comfortable with yourself?
No, I'm just. Do you think I'm comfortable with myself?
No.
Okay. Good. Good.
Judging by the fact by how many times you asked that question, I would say the answer is no.
You're the most uncomfortable with yourself of any human being ever.
I just think you know it's so easy to spin off the rails. You know, particularly in the mercurial business, and you know, like you have ups and you have downs, and you have things that you spend a lot of time throwing your emotions into, and sometimes they don't pay off. And so, what pulls you back and keeps you grounded? I guess is probably the better way to ask that question.
Probably if I don't know what really. I mean, we have to really figure out what the word grounded means. But I think because I'm so close to my children. They're such. They've always been my home.
Yeah.
That was my safe place. That's that outside world, and that can just like go there. And here I have all of them, and then that's and grandchildren, and so that's where I live. But also, I'm really a hermit. I'm very much like Doris in that. I'm really antisocial.
You know,
sort of notoriously.
Oprah once said that. I think it was Oprah who said this.
You get a car, and you get a car, and you get a car.
She said that. She yeah, did okay. say that too. that you know, like success and fame will make you more the person that you already were.
Right.
So if you're like a jerk mm-hmm. and you get really famous and successful, you'll be an even bigger jerk.
Yeah.
And if you're a good person and you get really successful and famous, it forces you to be an even better person.
Maybe, yeah, I guess I can see why that – I think
– And I've found that to be true.
Really?
I think so. That it yeah, you have to kind of step into the shoes that you believe are the shoes that you should be wearing.
I think there's a lot of like why are you doing it questions to be asked. You know, it's like if you're doing it – for a lot of external reasons, like, well, I want fame and I want success and I want money and I want all this stuff. And I feel like that's a very disappointing path, even if you get it, because then it doesn't fix you.
But there's also people that are are legitimately narcissistic, you know, people.
Are you talking about me? See, because that
that's what you did.
Well, there's
narcissists.
But there's so many. I'm talking about like narcissistic personality disorder to where like, you know, you give that person the opportunity to like be that person, and then you're confronting that.
I do. I think the business can be very difficult for that reason, because it doesn't sort of like you were saying. At a certain point, boundaries become a little less clear, and it's interesting because I feel you had your kids fairly young, didn't you? Yeah, and so you had a support structure that you needed to pay attention to from very early on.
Yeah, from early on.
And it's fortunate that you recognize that, because even just having kids doesn't always make people awesome people.
No, but it makes that you have to pay attention to these two little people saying, you know, when do we eat?
Right.
I was always somehow alone in it, you know, I was singly growing them all on my own. So, you know, it certainly changes your focus. And that becomes really where you're home and but I agree with you. You know, it really is about why are you doing this? Why have I been in this business for, you know, why have I been doing what I do by hook or by crook for 52 years or going on 53 or something? And it has to be because of the being able to have the opportunity to act in films and anywhere in television or films or on stage. But certainly like Doris, gives me a place to do what I do. And if it's ever been about, oh, I want to be famous or I want to be rich, forget it. Then you're going to get crushed because that ain't going to happen. And if it does happen momentarily, it's not going to be there for long.
Yeah. So it is basically just that's nice, but what's the next thing? What's the next thing? What's the next thing?
Yeah. Or, you know, taking the downtime and using it in a creative way.
What do you do in your downtime? That's not.
I suffer.
Are you a shark? Do you have to keep moving?
Well, I do. I keep moving, but it may not be in the kind of in the business sense. You know, I don't keep moving because I'm like, you know, hustling and looking for the next thing. I keep moving. My kids would always say, I never sit. I'm like sweeping, and then I'm like doing the windows, and then I'm saying what's to eat, and I'll do something.
Do you have, besides My Name is Doris, and besides family and human things, mm-hmm. what's your favorite thing that you've done where you look back and you go, I am so happy that worked out? Do you have a favorite project or a favorite thing, or is it just shades?
What would it be?
I don't know. There's a million.
I went out into the wilderness. And
No. I mean, movie.
One of your movies.
Oh, I thought you meant what thing out
is
of show business?
Is it Forrest Gump or Steel Magnolias?
No, I thought
or
you were saying what.
Could be the blooper reel from Smokey and the Bandit.
And out of, and not your, not show business and not your kids, what thing have you done that you're most proud of? I'm going, well, what would it be?
I was saying outside of My Name is Doris, which I'm sure in front of Michael you would say is your favorite thing.
You know what? I don't know what my favorite, I really don't know what my favorite thing is. I couldn't pick. I wouldn't pick. I can't. I mean, I couldn't say that. I don't know. I absolutely don't know.
Well, we can eliminate the flying nun.
I think we can eliminate that. And probably Beyond the Poseidon, we can eliminate that one.
So we've got two off the list right there.
Two are right off the list.
She has, I think, over 60 IMDb credits. That's two down.
That's two down.
60 to go.
Yeah. But so I imagine that everything must have some sort of a piece that's edifying in some way. But they're all, do they all feel different? Does every project feel different? Or does it all feel like, oh, this is a familiar, it's this thing again? Or is each one unique?
It depends on the caliber of the project and the work atmosphere and all of that. Like we've said, you know, there's those moments where you get, you know, you do something because you know you've, well, I've got to, okay, this, I can make this work, and you know you're going to get a paycheck. Okay, I guess I have to do it. And from day one, you think, how the holy hell am I going to get through this? I mean, how am I going to make it? And you know, you make calendars in every room to cross off the day, cross off the hours, and then crossing off. I have things where I literally cross off the minute. Okay, we haven't done another half hour is done. Where you just like, your life is like, you're dying here. You know, there's those experiences. But the ones that are, you know, that I will always cherish, and certainly Doris being one of them, it's almost like it doesn't matter that there's a that there's a film after it. It's like, wait a minute, we get to have a movie too? It was like we had this little time together. We had this little voyage. We went on a voyage for 3 weeks and 3 days. And that was what I got. I got, that was my time. And then you go, oh, there's a movie now. Wait a minute. Now we have to support this because maybe no one will see it and then it will die and maybe that experience will be criticized for being not a good experience. But you hold these, and I've been lucky enough to have several experiences of making something, making a film that was worth the experience of doing it, even whatever the film was.
And so that's ultimately how you decide. You just get that feeling when you read something, mm-hmm. this is going to be worth my time. This is a human enough of a thing that is important to me.
Something clicks inside of me. Something. It's something.
Were you nervous the first day you guys worked together?
Yes.
Very. And as the director, you're supposed to know what the hell's going on.
Yeah. I mean, the first day is always weird anyway. Because
we're all nervous.
You're all nervous. And it's like that first time, when you do that first take, you're like, wow, we just... You're really free fall. Like, oh my God, we're making this movie now. It's happening. And we shot some difficult stuff on that first day.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, add to how nervous you are just to be directing a movie at all, and then that the person that you're directing is her. Very nervous, but you know, you get through it. And Sally was, you know, we'd already kind of gotten to know each other a little bit. And so it was like we were already kind of, I kind of knew a little bit about how she worked and how this was going to go and everything. But yeah, I was nervous.
We were already linked. I was nervous too. Yeah. You know, we talked about it. I was like, yeah.
Well, it was the first time you'd worn the clothes on.
With the character land.
Yeah. Yeah. And it was the first time you'd really been her.
Yeah.
Like, I see, you know, that's that thing, you know, like, it was the first time we'd actually seen the character. Like we'd kind of done it. We had done the little rehearsal-y kind of things and with the script and kind of a little bit of feeling it around. But this was like, this is the character now. And it's a pretty intense moment when you go, wow, there she is. There's Doris. She's over there sitting on the couch. And I can only imagine what that must have felt like for you. When I say I can only imagine, I mean I can't imagine. What I meant to say was I can't only imagine, or I can't imagine.
Is that a question?
Sure. Oh. Yeah.
I don't know. I just you know it's the intense concentration. You know, that sort of self hypnosis place you put yourself in as an actor to arrive someplace that isn't really you, and to also harness all of the things that are you and put them out of the way, you know, physicality and things to try to have Doris's rhythm and Doris's personality. It's just, you know, then you wake up at the end of the day, like slap yourself. Oh, hello, I'm back. It's just huge, you know, that intense concentration. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Are you in that character the entire time? Like when you go home, or do you like, can you leave it at the door like a job?
No, you have to sort of hang on to it. You know, mm-hmm. you have to, and you kind of hang on to it all day and however you are. Just you try to hover there. And it was always hard for me because early in my life, it was new that actors would act like that. So I'd have to try to hide it because then they would think there was something wrong with me. I was mentally. And at one point, like on Sybil, when I was like that, I was on the streets of New York and someone called the police that there was a crazy woman standing outside of their store. And we were like getting ready to shoot. And I was standing outside of the store sort of going like that, you know, sort of, you know, bobbing back and forth, concentrating on the being the character. And the people in the store called the police.
Oh, my God.
There's a very strange homeless person out here. And going.
That was kind of your first award.
So it's like, hi. Yeah.
Oh, no, we're doing
yeah. You'll see. No, I really, and the AD had to go tell him to back off because I couldn't get out of my character enough to say, to be anybody but Sybil at that moment.
So obviously, so Sybil has a very strong hook. Doris has a hook. You know who she is. But when you get a role, it's like I always wonder, like, the Aunt May Parker characters of the world where it's like, well, she's a sweet lady.
Yeah.
Well, what about her? Well, she's a sweet lady.
Yeah.
You know, like the characters without a real obvious, mm-hmm. obvious yeah. hook. Do you like that challenge?
No. That was hard. I was really there. I loved Andrew just to pieces. Loved him. But I was really there because my first producing partner was Laura Ziskin. Mm-hmm. And I loved her. And we made Murphy's Romance together. It was mm-hmm. her first film. And then she went on to do just gobs of stuff and be a very important woman in the industry. And we knew this was going to be her last film. She was dying of breast cancer. And she had fought hell of a fight, and at the same time really raised she was a hero. She raised all of this money and brought these research doctors together demanding that they talk to each other when the doctors were competitive with each other and wouldn't bring their research all together to try to, you know, combat this horrible thing, which is breast cancer. And we knew that it had come back and that she was not going to win this time. And she asked me, she called me and said, we're making Spider-Man again. Would you be Aunt May? And I was doing a television series at the time. I was doing Brothers and Sisters. And I said, yes, I'll be there. I didn't read the script. I didn't know what it was. I didn't care what it was. I needed to be there. And I was. So every day was fine. Yeah. And I got to work with Andrew. Yeah. So it was fine. Better than fine. I got paid.
You did?
Yeah.
But you also did that. You also did something for your friend, which was...
Yeah, and so I was super glad to be there.
So as we're sort of winding this down, first of all, everyone should know that my name is Doris. Opens 11th, but wide March 18th.
Yes.
You're wider March
18th. Yes, yes, yes.
Do you have any kind of, any last nugget of wisdom that you can leave with people? Just something? I mean, as someone who has... Just hearing all the stories of, like, you know, you came up against this wall and you figured out how to get around it. You came up against this and you got angry and you yanked the pages out of the... Like, what is it? What's the fire in your, you know... I think my manager would call that the fire in the belly. Like, what's your fire in the belly? Like, how do you keep pushing through and pushing through and pushing through no matter what?
I think the real question is, how do you quit pushing through for me? I mean, how do I how do I just say, okay, that's enough. That's fine. Thank you so much. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not really sure what's next, even though I kind of know what's next, but I'm not telling you what it is.
Damn it.
please. I know.
Okay, I thought that would work. No. I gave puppy dog eyes.
No.
It didn't.
No. But I don't know. I'll just keep going until the flame dwindles and I decide to, you know, sit down. Or I just can't find a spot to put myself anymore.
I mean, it's clear that would only happen if you just didn't want to do stuff anymore.
Well,
if you're
that's
like, well,
it
just
nice
isn't
of you.
Fulfilling anymore, or you didn't want to do it anymore, or whatever.
Well, that's very nice of you. I keep saying we ought to do Doors too. I'm saying she goes to Paris and
exactly.
does the catwalk.
I'm writing it as we're writing it as we speak.
The designer's finder. Yes. She's the
but then
head,
it goes to
head
her head.
Girl
she gets very successful.
Doors is such a great character. I think you should do a series of films that I'll explore. Each sequel is a different genre. So there's like a horror. Then there's a sci-fi Doris. Then there's an action Doris.
Doris gets marooned on Mars, you mean?
Yes. Yes.
Well, I'd like to do with Doris what we did with Wet Hot, which is we get Sally and Tyne Daly and Caroline Ahrens, and we go to Netflix and we do a sequel on Netflix.
That would be fantastic. Is there a genre that you haven't – is there a genre that you would like to do more of?
I've never really done any horror stuff. I don't really like it. I don't know that I want to do, but I do really good horrors beyond belief good.
Yeah.
I mean, please. Alien, all of that. I mean, that's horror. I mean, it's my favorite thing. I love, the Hitchcockian sort of, I would like to do gothic Hitchcock. I've never done that kind of sort of stuff. I mean, period. But except for Mary Todd, she was pretty gothic. I don't know.
Mary Todd anything. Lincoln was pretty gothic.
Yeah, wasn't she?
She was a dark character.
Yeah, she was.
A very dark character. But, you've both been amazing. And I'm very proud of you, Michael Showalter.
Thanks,
and I hope
Chris.
That doesn't sound arrogant.
Thanks, Chris.
But just, it's one of my favorite things, and maybe you feel this way too, is when you start off with people and you notice, like, oh, there's those, I like them. And then you kind of see when you get to be in the business for a little while and you see like, oh, you're doing great. And everyone's – it's kind of nice.
It is? That's unusual.
Really?
Because there's a lot of people that go, if he's achieving something, it means I must be losing something.
No, yeah. Those people are horrible.
Well, I have a resentment. I have a resentment towards you because I've done At Midnight twice. Mm-hmm. And I go on knowing this is going to happen. I'm always –
and you got eliminated.
First, both times.
I tried.
Like help. I'm that guy.
You need
I'm
to-
the guy – I'm the guy that gets eliminated for something.
Can I tell you, there's the trick to At Midnight is
I've
the
been
buzzer.
Told the trick.
It's the buzzer. The buzzer, the game show element of that show really works. If you lean on the buzzer and you get answers in faster, that's the trick.
The last time I did it, I really felt like emotionally defeated.
The
like,
ref. Huh?
Yeah, I was like, I can't do this anymore.
Well,
like,
you can come back on.
And give it and can you rig it?
Yeah, I'll rig it.
Can you rig it so that I at least make it to the neck to the
yes.
showdown round?
Thank yes,
you.
I promise Thank the next you. Time you come on that we will be rigged.
We will do that.
We will do that for you. No, it won't be rigged. It'll just work out well for you.
Okay, good.
All right. Just say that. It's not rigged, it's just the universe is smiling on you. Sally Field, Michael Showalter, thank you for being here. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Thank you.
And thank you.
Thank you, Chris.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.
This episode of the Nerdist Podcast is brought to you by The Bronze.
The Bronze.
A film starring Melissa Rauch, Gary Cole, Thomas Middleditch, Sebastian Stan, Cecily Strong, and Haley Lou Richardson. The Bronze opens everywhere on March 18th, only in theaters. Go see it.
The Bronze.